He struck terror into the hearts of those he killed, those he hurt, and those who feared they'd be next. The Golden State Killer cut a deadly swath across thousands of miles in California, leaving hundreds of victims and decades of trauma. But some of his victims lived and told police what they saw. Tonight, the heroic survivors, investigators, and prosecutor who helped haul in a monster and lock him up forever on Banfield. He stalked his prey in California, mostly young women, not always alone, some with little children, some with husbands or boyfriends, and fueled by pure evil, he would strike. His MO was almost always the same. At gunpoint, he would slowly and methodically tear up the sheets and then use the ribbons to bind the women. The men and the children, often, he would bind them too and would place a pile of dishes on the men's backs. Say one move, one sound, one broken dish, and they would meet instant death. He then brutalized the women, while the children or the men who were bound and helpless nearby could only listen or watch. The lucky ones lived through the hours of agonizing torture. The unlucky ones were shot dead. And he did this for decades through the 70s and 80s without getting caught. Joseph James DeAngelo fooled the police for a very long time, probably because he himself was a cop. He was so sick and twisted and specialized, they thought he was three different people. The East Area Rapist, the Visalia Ransacker, and the original Night Stalker. But eventually they made headway, and they put the pieces together, and they named him the Golden State Killer. And they caught him. Gay Hardwick and Chris Pedretti survived his attacks and are with me now, as is Mary Regal, a trauma therapist who has counseled several women that DeAngelo attacked. Ladies, thank you so much for joining this program this evening. Gay, I'd like to start with you to recount for me, if you can, what happened the night DeAngelo entered your life?
Well, my husband and I had purchased a home. We hadn't married yet. And we had had a typical Friday night and gone to a movie and came home and went to bed. And then we were awakened, like was the usual experience of the victims, by a voice in a glaring light. Wake up and... I have a gun, and we were, in a deep state of sleep, and it's very hard to process something like that. So
once you did process it, and once you realized that he was real, it was not a nightmare, what happened next?
You know, he threatened us with death repeatedly. He forced me to tie up my husband. And he separated us, my husband staying in our room at the far end of the house, and I was force marched to the opposite end in the family room. And then I was attacked repeatedly for a couple of hours. And in between those attacks, he would go room to room and empty drawers and, go into the refrigerator, sit on the patio, drink a beer, make me think maybe he was gone. And as soon as I moved, he was back. He really relished, making me as uncomfortable as possible, leaving the door open in a very cold March night with the wind blowing through. And, I remember being extremely cold.
What does your husband remember of that night?
His experience was being in limbo, unable to move and unable to free himself for fear that if the dishes fell, I would be murdered, or certainly he would be murdered. And the decisions we made that night were to stay alive. And we did everything we could to not escalate the human being that was in our home.
It is remarkable that you did survive, and thank God for that. Chris Pedretti, you also survived. At the time, you were one of his youngest victims. I think you were 15 years old. Chris, can you tell me what happened to you?
Yes. So I was 15, like you said, and that night I was going to go to a high school dance. It was December 18th. It was just a week before Christmas. And my parents decided, well, they were going to go to a Christmas party, but it was not a big deal for me to stay home because my sister was at work and she'd be home by 9. And so I began to play the piano, just, you know, wasting time. And all of a sudden there, you know, it was 7:30 at night. And all of a sudden I could see kind of out of my peripheral vision that something was moving. But before I could even process it, there was a knife at my throat and him saying that he would push the knife all the way through if I screamed or moved. So I didn't scream or move. And he then took me down the hallway, tied me in the laundry room, my wrists, and then out to the backyard patio table where it was cold, and cut my clothes off, and then just left me out there while he ransacked the house.
Did he do the same things, Chris, that he did, that you heard Gay describe, as so many other survivors have described as well?
Yeah, he did, except that it was just me. I didn't have another person in the home, so there wasn't anyone tied with dishes on their back or anything like that. But absolutely, right when you would think maybe he left, he's sitting right next to you and telling you to be still or quiet. He took me in and out of different rooms to rape me and then would return me back outside. So I would say I 100% agree with Gay that his whole, you know, purpose was to terrify us and for us to believe that we were going to die. And he certainly did that. You know, at one point I was just, to myself, I can't do this anymore. If he's going to kill me, so be it, because I can't lay bound and not knowing what's going to happen another minute.
How long did it go on, Chris?
I think about an hour and a half to 2 hours.
It's remarkable that you're able to recall. I mean, especially as a girl, you know, 15 years old, you would think a lot of this you might block, but it's remarkable that you had such clarity in your memories about this. You know, Mary, there's something to that. These women are so brave and helpful to the investigators who, after decades, finally found this man. They are the people who helped to do that. Is it very difficult to go back and extract those details to help investigators, especially since it was so different back then, the way things were investigated?
Oh, absolutely. It's difficult to go back. We're made to kind of put trauma aside so we can keep on living. I mean, not putting it aside, I should say. It attaches to our whole lives. But we're meant to keep on living and be that resilient person. I think the striking thing that I noticed is how the maturity of all his victims that came forward today or this last couple of years really changes the dialogue, because we're talking about victims now who have the wisdom of life. They can go back and see what they have done and how they managed to survive and how they managed to take care of themselves all these years. So yes, it is different than a fresh assault. You know, it's very different than a brand new assault. And because
I can imagine, I mean, I suppose I yeah. can't imagine is probably the better response to that. When we come back after the break, we're going to dig into the other facet of that, and that is catching a monster and putting him in a courtroom with the people he terrorized decades before, catching D'Angelo and putting him away for life. What that does in the trajectory of healing. Welcome back to our very special episode about the people who helped to find, capture, and convict a monster. Gay Hardwick and Chris Pedretti have very similar stories. They were both raped and terrorized by the same man in the 1970s, a man who became known as the Golden State Killer. But they survived. And decades later, they courageously spoke against him at the trial that put him away. It took until 2018 to even catch him. Decades later, we're also joined by Mary Regal, a trauma therapist who has counseled several people attacked by the Golden State Killer. Gay, one of the troubling details of this, there's no other way to describe him other than monster, is that he would often call his victims afterwards just to re-traumatize them. And as I understand it, that happened to you.
I did receive a phone call many years later. It was about 7 years later, and my husband had just left the home, and it was as though someone knew that he had just left. And I got this phone call, and there was this heavy breathing at the other end, and I just had the belief that it was the same man. And it was just very chilling, and I thought that couldn't be possible. But years later, I learned in talking with investigators that was not uncommon, even many years after an attack, that he would call.
That he did that to other victims. At the moment that you got that call, I can only imagine that you would be terrified that he was going to show up again. What did you do?
By then I had children and I was in my own home. I convinced myself at that time that it couldn't be. And then it was, as I said, years later, talking with investigators, that I learned that it probably was.
Well, it's probably a pretty good coping mechanism as well, just to be able to get through that. Chris, when the news came in 2018, nearly four decades after these crimes began, that they caught him, that they had the man that did this, I won't say closure, but it was resolution of some kind. But what did it feel like? What did it mean to you?
For me, as a young person, you just keep living, and I just had convinced myself he was dead. And so when I got the news that he had been captured, it was really like a trigger back to the day that the rape happened. And, obviously later I was happy, but at that moment, just trying to process that this person had been kind of raised from the dead, like he's in our sphere all this time, was very scary for me. And angry. I was angry that I had to deal with this again because I had pretty well buried it. So I say the best way I explained it was every emotion that I could feel, I felt at once. And it was very overwhelming. And plus I was by myself. I was on a business trip in a hotel, and my support system was nowhere around. So I would say, resolution definitely came later, but that day was just, letting the tiger out of the cage and having to deal with it finally, with no choice whether to deal with it or not. It was here. So
I can imagine, Mary Regal, that would be, there would be a range of emotions for a lot of people going through this. A lot of the survivors hearing finally they got him. But that would bring up exactly what Chris just said. Maybe not all a satisfactory feeling, but a re-traumatization. How do you help people through that?
Oh, well, I just think that is such a actually a difficult question to answer. We help people by kind of neutralizing the memory. And the goal is to have people feel safe when they are safe. And all this time, people have been living in, you know, the victims have been living in kind of, you know, is he alive? Is he dead? You know, where is he? And when they caught him, that all that way of the survival mechanisms get kind of shattered in a way, and they have to recoup now. They have to pull themselves together and say, okay. And the great thing is they found each other. And so these victims were, so many of them found each other because of this, that they were able to help each other get reoriented to this idea that, in fact, he was captured and he can no longer hurt you. Or taunt you. So I think it's a combination of how we help people. We help with helping people get connected to other people, and then also just doing our work as trauma specialists and working at neutralizing a lot of the memory.
Seeing a lot of the survivors in the courtroom just so heroically giving their testimony, it makes me wonder not only how you get through it, how you agree to do it, how you agree to go there that day and face that man. Gay, I mean, how do you get to that point where you can walk in that room, in the same room where he's breathing the same air, and does it help?
Well, I didn't attend the hearings that I was entitled to attend during the first year. But in February, I believe it was, of 2019, I elected to attend a hearing. And so I did go. I had the support of another victim. Chris was there. I had already met her and made her acquaintance. She had gone to some hearings in the past. And so she was there, and we walked in and sat in the courtroom. And that was my first experience. At that time, it was a fairly perfunctory hearing that didn't result in any really any status change in the case. Just some formalities, and I did see him for the very first time in the same room. I then attended another hearing later in the spring where I knew what to expect, and I saw him again. And there is some very real truth to the fact that when someone is no longer masked and they have a face, that they lose their power. And I did not feel, I didn't feel anything toward the human that was in the wheelchair that was rolled into the courtroom.
And I will add to that, just having covered the case, that he was only in the wheelchair when it was convenient. But there were plenty of times where he wasn't, especially in his cell, exercising and doing all sorts of things without a wheelchair. So I tend to think he was trying to manipulate people around him, obviously. Chris, the fact that he was a police officer, looking at him caged there and knowing that he did this and he was supposed to be protecting us, he was supposed to be protecting you. Did you feel cheated that it was a deal and that he escaped the death penalty?
No, I don't think so. I think that I was just happy he was caught. And, but, you know, as we continue to heal, I think that I,
I do think about that. And I have been, I had jury duty once, and all of the police, you know, that were in the hallways completely triggered me. And so I think as we work through the process and the immediate trauma and the immediate flashbacks and just trying to heal, it didn't really resonate with me, but it is resonating with me now more. And it tells me, you really have to be careful who you trust. And that includes police officers. And that puts us in another unsafe situation, because who are you supposed to call when you're in trouble? And so I do think now I do see where that can continue to be a problem, right? Because man in uniform isn't really there to help you all the time.
Well, I commend you both, Gay and Chris, for your heroics. And it's really nothing short of that. For those who've never walked in your shoes, they ought to know just the strength that it requires to do what you did and also to carry on. And you've obviously done that with aplomb and dignity and grace. So my great thanks to both of you, Gay and Chris, and Mary Regal as well. Thank you for sharing your insight. And I appreciate your stories, ladies. Thank you. After the break, that cold case investigator who said maybe DNA and genealogy might help in this investigation. Maybe those techniques might find the guy. Maybe that's how we'll catch the Golden State Killer. And oh boy, was he right. Welcome back to our very special episode about the people who helped to find, capture, and convict the Golden State Killer. Paul Holes is one of those people. He is a former cold case investigator for the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office in California, and he helped to uncover the Golden State Killer's true identity by using advanced DNA and genealogy technology. He hosts the weekly podcast Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad. Paul Holes, it's so good to have you here. Can you take me back to 1994 when you're a young detective and you see a filing cabinet with some dog-eared manila files and you think, I want to get a look at that?
Yeah, I literally was just working in a crime lab, and I was in the crime lab's library, and there was an old file cabinet that nobody ever seemed to go to. So I decided to see what was in there. In the bottom drawer were these yellow manila folders labeled with a red EAR at the top. And when I opened them up, I found out that that red EAR stood for East Area Rapist. And it appeared to be an unsolved series of rapes from the 1970s. Little did I know that it would blow into a statewide crime spree that involved homicides.
So 20 years after, you know, this reign of terror by this monster, you're a self-starter and you decide, I'm going to take a brand new look with what we have in our, you know, our kit these days. And that is the potential for genealogy to actually make a difference. So walk me through how you applied an old case to a brand new science.
Well, all along, I was attempting new technologies over the decades. And back in 2012, I had tried an older version of genealogy based on DNA. And it was in 2017 that I stumbled across this new technique that was being used to help adoptees find their biological parents. And it was just coincidence. I had another case, and I was alerted that somebody we had been trying to identify for decades was identified using this technique. And so I called the genealogist up, Barbara Ray Venter, and said, hey, could this be used to find the identity of an unknown offender? And Barbara said, I see no reason why it wouldn't work. And from that point on, that was the entire focus of the investigation.
So as simply as, and I always say, talk to me like I'm five, because this is complicated stuff. But effectively, you, as I understand it, you bring the concentric circles narrower and narrower and narrower, finding closer and closer relatives, those who actually could have been there or might have been in the area and aren't already dead. So walk me through how quickly you got to the suspect in this case and then what you had to do to really get him.
Yeah, well, with the technique, you know, ultimately as you're working with these relatives that are related and typically distantly related through DNA, you start building out family trees and then hoping to find individuals that you think are born in the generation that you think the offender, the Golden State Killer, was born. And then now, once you start settling into finding males that were in California in the 1970s, it is just straight investigation 101. Well, who are these men? Could they be the killer? And it's now going and investigating each person. And a lot of them we could very quickly eliminate because we knew so much about the Golden State Killer, where he was, when, his size. But fundamentally, it took us about 4 months from the time that we got some genealogy results to the time that we narrowed down on this ex-cop, this Joseph DeAngelo. And I remember when I first started looking at him, I was like, well, there's no way he's the guy, but maybe he's a relative. And so I started digging into him.
Oh, just the notion that you come across an ex-cop, I cannot even imagine what first goes through your mind, but disbelief would be, you know, a euphemism for it. So, Paul, what's amazing is you go from the lab and from the genealogy and the, you know, microscopic smoking guns to just straight gumshoe. And as I get it, you just follow these potential suspects and pick up what they leave behind so that you can test it. Because it's legal to pick up someone's trash if they're dumping out a glass or something, a tissue or something with DNA on it.
Well, if the person deposits their DNA in a public space, that's what's critical. Then it is, in essence, abandoned property. And now it is legal for law enforcement to collect that sample and do DNA testing on it if the person is a suspect. And so that is exactly what a surveillance team did. Is we had DeAngelo under surveillance, and the initial sample was when he drove himself to a Hobby Lobby store. He parked his car in a public parking spot, and an undercover agent went up and swabbed his car door handle. And the initial results came back, oh, he's the Golden State Killer, but it was a mixed sample. So we had to get a second sample. And that's when we waited for him to put his trash out on public property. And a piece of tissue inside his trash can had a single source DNA sample that 100% matched the DNA that the Golden State Killer had left behind 4 decades before.
It's just so incredibly remarkable that it's almost so simple, but it isn't. I know, Paul, that you've said in the past, it's not about closure when you are able to tell the victims, we got him. It's about bringing them an answer. And then you end up in court and he takes a deal. No death penalty, life in prison. I know that the survivors will feel a certain way about that. I wonder about the investigators like you. How satisfied were you with that?
You know, for me, getting the answer was what the goal was all about. It was getting these survivors and the victims' families that answer. And then the justice system often takes its own path. For me, it was important, and I heard directly from the victims that they were satisfied with the outcome. And, you know, when you have so many victims, of course, you have differing opinions as to whether or not it was a satisfactory outcome. But by and large, the victims that I talked to, the survivors I talked to, they seemed to be happy with how things played out. They, of course, wanted to see him stand trial. They wanted all the details of his horrendous crimes to come out, what he did to them or what he did to their loved ones. But in the end, he is going to be incarcerated for the rest of his life.
Very satisfying to hear those words for all of us, let alone the people who survived his horrors. Paul, thank you so much for doing the work that you do, for being so dedicated, and then for being on the program. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, Ashley.
Coming up after the break, Paul is a fantastic male detective. And back in the 70s, there were great male detectives as well. But they didn't always perhaps speak to the female survivors in the way that the female survivors felt comfortable. And then along came one who made all the difference. Find out about that next.
in this community here in Sacramento, the memories are very vivid. You can ask anyone that grew up here. Everyone has a story. But it must be remembered that it was not just Sacramento, that this case deeply affected this entire state. There were upwards of 50 rapes, 12 murders, crimes that spanned 10 years across at least 10 different counties, Northern, Central, and Southern California. And it was that day in June of 2016 that we, in public safety, reiterated our commitment to the victims and to justice. In this case, the East Area Rapist, the Golden State Killer.
Welcome back to a very special episode of Banfield about the people who helped to identify, capture, and convict the Golden State Killer. You just heard from one of those people, Sacramento County District Attorney Anne-Marie Schubert. She's credited with leading the recent pursuit and capture of Joseph DeAngelo. Anne-Marie, it's great to have you on this special. Thank you so much. That day, I can only imagine that that day had to feel satisfying, but also just a day of mixed emotions, knowing what all of those survivors were going through.
I think it was surreal, and it was something that we've never experienced before, and hopefully we never will again. But absolutely at the heart of it all was bringing justice to these crime victims so that they could actually put a face to that DNA profile on the man that had terrorized the state for really decades.
You actually were very hands-on, as I understand it, interviewing and, you know, collating facts, evidence from what effectively were cold cases with women who had been traumatized decades prior. That is a very tender subject and a very difficult line to walk. Help me through that. Might be a little different that you're a woman. Things were handled differently in the 70s and 80s, but
absolutely.
Take me through your science.
Well, I think for me, I think part of it was because I grew up in Sacramento. I understood the impact it had on this community. I also had the fortune of getting involved in DNA cases over 25 years ago, and it was back then that I realized the power of the technology. And, you know, I went on a mission with a number of other people that had really spent their careers dedicated to trying to find this needle in this haystack. But the also part is that I have sat with crime victims, particularly sexual assault survivors and victims and homicide families that have been destroyed by these horrific violent crimes. And so I understood the impact from their perspective. I understood the impact from a personal perspective because I had lived here during these time periods. But I also understood the value of the science of pursuing every potential tool that we could utilize. And so when we realized that this investigative genetic genealogy was going to revolutionize really crime solving, we knew that we had to do it on this particular case.
But then there's that personal evidence gathering, right? Sometimes in a cold case, a brand new perspective and a brand new interview does actually yield that special nugget, or at least some helpful prosecutorial nuggets. And that's the hard part, interviewing people whose lives have been upended. What was your special sauce?
I think for those of us that, you know, have grown up, as I say, in the trenches and have, as I've said, sat with folks, you can appreciate their lives have been forever changed. It oftentimes, and particularly with this case, their lives were changed, their children's lives were changed, their partners' lives were changed. It changed how they raised their children. It changed the professions that they chose. And for many, particularly homicide victims, the family members never see the sunlight again at the same again. And so you have to understand that and put that into their perspective, that while we do not stand in their shoes, we can have tremendous empathy and we can advocate for them because that's our obligation, is to stand up in that courtroom and to do everything we can to give them the voice that oftentimes has not been listened to for years. And that's what happened in this particular case, is that ultimately, and these extraordinary victims, both men and women, children, adults, have endured incredible trauma, but have also, many of them, turned that into this powerful message. As one of them once said, you know, she turned her mess into a message. And many of them have gone on to become these incredible advocates for survivors of sexual assault and advocates for homicide victims' families. And it's truly an extraordinary journey that they've been on. And I'm really proud to know them personally as well as professionally.
Yeah, well, Chris Pedretti and Gay Hardwick have been talking to us about these experiences and then living for the last several decades through the journey. I actually, because you just said that about the important voice that they had, you know, in the case, I want to play a moment where Chris Pedretti addressed the court in her victim impact statement. I think it was very profound. I think it also speaks a lot to what you just mentioned, and that is, you know, living in that community and knowing a lot of what they were going through. Have a listen to what she had to say in court.
Okay.
There are parts of me that spent more than four decades alone, entrapped in a virtual hell that D'Angelo sentenced me to in 1976, from which I could not escape. I used to wonder why I was chosen to be his victim. It used to keep me up at night. It was the only question I had for him. Why? What could I have done differently to create a different ending that night?
So, Anne-Marie, many of the survivors said that they suffered in silence, thinking that they were alone with what had happened to them. Many of them just went to work, you know, within a couple of days, because back then, you know, in some jurisdictions, it was a misdemeanor, for heaven's sake, you know, get over it, was a lot of prevailing wisdom. Mm-hmm. But then you came along and a lot of people found each other. Do you think that galvanized many of them to say, I'm in, I want to be part of this prosecution, I want to be in court to say those things?
I absolutely understand and believe that many of them joined together in a very collaborative, unifying effort. And many of them did not want to be referred to as Jane Doe number 12 or whatever it was, because they understood that they now had the power that they felt like had been taken from them. It was really, it's extraordinary to see what these folks have gone through and where they've traveled and how far they've come. I you know, Chris Pedretti, you know, maybe 2 days after this arrest, I brought me 42 roses as a sign of how many years she had to wait. And now she's this incredible advocate. Her and Gay Hardwick and so many of these other folks have now galvanized themselves together and are doing amazing things for other folks that have become victims of sexual assault, and really allowing people to tell their stories so that they can be heard, and it's no longer a shame, or it's not shameful, and they have no responsibility in the assault that they suffered, but in fact the perpetrator does. So it's been an extraordinary journey for many of them. I've gone to their homes and I've seen them and I've met them, and it's really wonderful to see what many of these people have done to help others and to give back to the communities themselves.
Well, when we come back after the break, Anne-Marie, listen, I've done decades of crime reporting, and one of the things that's so beguiling is cold cases, old cases, mm-hmm. when memory and evidence fades or crumbles. Not in this case. And I want to talk with you about the linchpins that put that man away. That's next. Welcome back to a very special episode of Banfield about the people who identified, captured, and prosecuted the Golden State Killer. Back with me is Sacramento County DA Anne-Marie Schubert. So, Anne-Marie, one of the things that I just said before break was that it is so hard. It's so hard to solve a cold case, but it is maybe even more difficult to prosecute it, given that memories fade and evidence sometimes goes missing, and defense attorneys can really mine that to their client's mm-hmm. advantage. In the case of these survivors, their memories seemed ironclad, which may have been extraordinarily helpful along with that DNA. But I want to play for you Gay Hardwick in that courtroom. She gave a very powerful statement, and it wasn't lost on anybody. Take a look at this.
Mm-hmm. I survived those repeated attacks, the hours of terror, the understanding that during those hours, there was a purely evil presence in our home, a diabolical, depraved, mumbling, and weeping being in human form.
So, yes, there is emotion, but with that emotion came a lot of detail. And many of these survivors had specifics. Was that what really sealed this case, or did it all just come down to the genealogical DNA?
I think it's a combination. I mean, listen, these victims were just terrorized. And, you know, to have a stranger break into your home and do these types of things is a rare event. And when those types of things happen, I would imagine they're seared in the memories for decades, obviously, in this case. But, it, you know, their resilience was obviously an incredible force in this case. But the DNA, at the end of it all, I knew since 2020 when I first started, 2000 when I first started getting involved in this case, I knew that was going to ultimately be the answer, because you can't lie about your DNA, and that memory doesn't fade. You know, I used to call it the silent witness to the truth, because while people's memories may fade or people may pass, your DNA is not going to change, and it's always going to be there to be the silent witness to the truth. And so you had a combination of that DNA and these powerful folks that have come forward to tell their story in very, very vivid details. And ultimately, that's what brought it all together and put this man in prison for the rest of his life.
Well, as an officer in law enforcement, you know, someone whose whole work is law and justice, it must have been a hell of a gut punch to learn that he was a former police officer.
You know, it's a gut punch in the sense that it obviously puts a black mark, but it was something that was suspected for years. And really, to me, it didn't matter what his profession was. It was a matter was that he was a serial rapist and a serial killer. And so whether he's a police officer, a priest, a doctor, a lawyer, whatever he is, if you're going to commit those kinds of crimes, we're going to find you, and we're going to prosecute you, and we're going to put you in prison if you deserve that sentence. And that's what happened here.
I have just about 45 seconds left, but does it keep you up at night that it wasn't a death penalty? Instead, it was a settlement?
No, it doesn't, because for these families, they got to have their day in court. As one of the victim's family members said, you know, I'd rather him die a convict than die an accused. And so for them, I think the answer was that he was caught and he's in prison for the rest of his life, and he'll die in prison.
You got that right. It's satisfying to see him behind bars, I think, as well for so many people. Anne-Marie Schubert, thank you so much for, A, your incredible work on that case, and then B, your voice in this special. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much.
And my great thanks also go to Gay Hardwick, Chris Pedretti, Mary Regal, and also Paul Holes for his investigative work as well. My thanks to all of you for watching this program. This is a difficult topic, and it continues to be for so many people who suffer at the hands of people like this. It's good to keep them in your thoughts. We'll see you again tomorrow.